You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Monday, May 22nd, 2017. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Professor Stephen Hahn, Pulitzer Prize winning author. His most recent, A Nation Without Borders, U.S. and its world in an age of civil wars, 1830 to 1910. And then moving about 110 years forward from there, Donald Trump exhausted, but yet to create a major crisis aboard. Thank heavens for small miracles, although it's still time. At home, by the end of the day, we will know, however, if the Trump administration is deciding to blow up Obamacare. Those payments that provide subsidies to people on the exchanges, we will find out if the White House continues to fight the lawsuit brought by the Republicans. Also on the program today, the Trump budget revealed. We're going to see the details tomorrow, but it's quite clear, massive, massive attacks on our safety net, amongst other government programs. Meanwhile, the White House is actively studying impeachment process and ways to undercut the new special counsel Mueller, particularly when it comes to investigating Jared. That's weird.
It's due diligence.
Betsy DeVos tries to further commodify education. James Comey just working out the details as to his public testimony. Michael Flynn, on the other hand, planning to take the fifth. More leaks. Jared in the hot seat. Have we even been on air since the nut job comment? Felt like it was years ago, but you've all heard about it now. David Clark, maybe a soon-to-be DHS official. Lots of plagiarizing going on there, not to mention his made-up military uniform he wears. The White House shuts down announcements as to who has received ethics waivers. And the FCC took its first vote en route to destroying net neutrality. I got about four or five other stories, too. But we just don't have the time. Maybe tomorrow we will not have a guest, and I will go over some of these stories. There's a couple of things, you know. There's apparently a global penicillin shortage because the free market works so fine. Well, maybe we'll get to that tomorrow. It is. We had another one of those weekends where it seemed like there were 7 to 8 days of news and about 15 minutes of just relaxation. That's the way it felt for me. Friday night, went on his program, there were like 3 breaking stories during the 15 minutes I was waiting to get on. You've got, obviously, President Trump bragging to the Russians, I got rid of Comey. He was a nut job. Which story in the Washington Post that made it clear that Jared Kushner is a subject of an ongoing investigation in terms of shady financial dealings with Russians, particularly a, I think, a bank that is specifically supposed to be subject to the embargo. We had, gosh, I can't even remember what the other story was. Well, the Flynn was, the Russians felt Flynn could influence Donald Trump's decision-making process, and apparently he did in the in terms of some things with the Turks. We now know also that Donald Trump, that John Bonner had to be sort of phoned in to keep Donald Trump from vetoing the bill that kept the continuing resolution, the bill that kept the country, the government to open a couple of weeks ago. And the really the fascinating thing about this from a just a palace intrigue standpoint, I don't want to get too caught up in it, but I mean, what are you going to do? Mike Pence, if not Mike Pence, then his chief of staff or some dude in the White House is leaking this. Someone who is ostensibly part of the administration, right? Now, you have some leaks where it attacks, you know, Jared. You remember that when Bannon and Jared were going at it with each other a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month ago now, Bannon's associates said in the New York Times, and this is back, I guess, this is in April, early April, I guess it was just a month and a half ago. Quote, Mr. Bannon has told confidants, that he believes Mr. Kushner's contact with Russians will become a major distraction for the White House. This is back in April. Now, that type of thing, that's just jockeying, right? That goes on in this office all the time. You're getting leaks from Matt about Michael, leaks of Kelly about me to Michael or to Matt that I have to find out, dig out, find out who did it. But what we're getting about, you know, when it's like there's, for instance, the president calling Comey a nut job, that has to come from somewhere. And who does that benefit to make Trump look like a moron? And maybe, I mean, to me, that doesn't make him look like a spy. That just makes him look like, I mean, the idea that anyone would trust him to be an asset is really hard to believe. I mean, I could say like, oh yeah, the Russians want him to be president because they thought it would screw up the country. But the idea they would be working in cahoots with him would be, I mean, I feel like that's the guy who gets called down to down the hall in the Kremlin, and you're fired. What were you thinking?
He's sort of the object that the agent would deliver, not really the agent.
Exactly. I honestly feel like you would trust working more like with a dolphin or something. I know they are. Maybe I should have just said a small house pet. But be that as it may, there's no assurance that you're working with a guy like Trump. But somebody in that White House is leaking, and I would bet it's Mike Pence. Speaking of assurance, let's talk about insurance. Hey, I've mentioned to you before my whole story about life insurance. When Milo was born, I got a 30-year term. When Saul was born, I realized I don't need to get 30-year. I just need to cover him until he gets through college. I don't know why I got term versus a whole life, but I was just, I don't know. I had it in my head that that's all I wanted to do. And so when I got term the second time, I got it for 20 years, but it was a little more expensive because I was a little bit older. The long and short of it is and I do this with all our advertisers. I don't know why I do this. Well, I know why I do it, because I don't want to promote anything that could be garbage. And the fact is, I went on to Policy Genius's website. It's basically I don't know what you would call it, but it aggregates different life insurance. You go in. It's a life insurance marketplace. You get the most accurate quotes from the top A-rated life insurance company. And, of course, I do the subsequent look at, you know, the ratings of the insurance companies that it suggested to me. It has placed over $5 billion in life insurance for people like you and me. They have a simple, user-friendly website to shop and compare all the top-rated life insurance companies and give you the best options. I went through the whole process. I didn't buy it because I already have my my term life, but I could have saved significant money. And if I had a little more time, I'd look into, like, how do I cancel the existing policy I have and buy a new one? They have a licensed customer service team to help you find the best policy at the best price. And you can check out other insurance offerings while you're there, like pet insurance. I did not check that out. But I guess, like, if you have a dog and you're like Kelly and the dog is always getting sick, you might need to go take it to the hospital. And
no. Okay.
Go to PolicyGenius.com today. Save over 40% off of other prices for life insurance. When life insurers compete for your business, you save money. That's PolicyGenius. PolicyGenius.com. Check it out. You should, particularly if you're a new parent, and I know we have a couple, you need to get some type of life insurance policy. Zero jargon, zero sales pressure, zero hassle. Life insurance made easy, free quotes, zero hassle, peace of mind. Don't wait. Go to PolicyGenius.com today. And I got to say, honestly, it feels better, you know, when you do it. Just get it over with. I know there's a couple people out there who've been thinking about it.
I just like to say that I know a few people who have pet insurance and really have had to use it and value it. But Edie only ate that poison and the other time the glass just because she was a baby. It's not really lifestyle for her yet. We'll see.
And I don't know if they have insurance for when you get called on by the SPCA. Because you've revealed too much about the way you're abusing your own dog on like a radio program. I don't know if they have that.
I broke a glass and my landlord, it was the Brooklyn.
Tell it to the judge. Aww. Speaking of the judge, I'm a good judge of food. Well, actually, I'm not a great judge of food, but I know when I've had a good meal. And I had two this past week. I don't want to slam anything else. But we had pork medallions. We had some type of like noodle salad that was amazing. The night before that, we had one of the most amazing salads I've ever had. I wouldn't even be able to tell you what was in it. I think they had like celery root. When was the last time you had a salad with celery root, Matt? You don't even have to tell me. I know. It was never.
Yeah.
And why do I have two meals a week homemade that I can brag about? Blue Apron makes incredible home cooking easy and accessible by delivering seasonal recipes with step-by-step instructions, pre-proportioned ingredients right to your door, all for less than $10 per meal. You can even customize your recipes based on your preference and select a delivery option that's right for you. We have been sort of like pushing, we're not doing so much meat, and so we do a little more fish at our house, and a little more vegetarian. It's the way that we're rolling that way. You don't have to. Plus, there's no weekly commitment. You only get the deliveries when you want them. I've talked about how the kids got into cooking. Mila, no, she doesn't care anymore. She's done. At first, she was really psyched about it, and now she doesn't even want to talk to us. She doesn't want to even eat with us, frankly. She's just like, I'll just leave my food on the counter and I will come and get it. And then when you guys are done. But Saul's still into it. In May, some of the meals available. Beef teriyaki stir fry with sugar snap peas and lime rice. Oh, that lime rice sounds pretty good. Baked spinach egg flatbread with sauteed asparagus and lemon aioli. Three cheese and baby broccoli stromboli. With tomato and oregano dipping sauce. Crispy salmon and roasted potato salad with pickled mustard seeds and creme fraiche sauce. Can people tell that I'm starting to weep? Check out this week's menu. Get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/majority. That's blueapron, BlueBird.com/majority. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's BlueApron.com/majority. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. All right, folks. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Professor Stephen Hahn. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor of American History at New York University, a Pulitzer Prize winning author and author of his latest Nation Without Borders, The United States and Its World in an Age of Civil Wars, 1830 to 1910. Stephen Hahn, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So you choose 1830 to 1910. Why those 80 years?
Well, that's a good question. My book is part of a series that Viking Press does, a multi-volume history of the United States that Eric Foner has edited, and The chronology was broadly chosen by the press. Now, as it turned out, when I was originally contacted about doing this book, they were talking about roughly 1840-ish to the turn of the 20th century. And then it turned out that the person who was doing the volume that immediately precedes mine decided that she didn't really want to go much further than 1830. So I was asked if I would be okay to start in 1830, and since at that point I hadn't really written anything, I figured, you know, why not? And so as it turned out, I think it worked very well in what I was trying to do. And as far as the ending date went, that was something that actually emerged in the process of researching and writing the book. What was an appropriate point to end? It could have been 1900, it could have been 1896, could have been 1914, but because it ends actually with the Mexican Revolution and looks to the 19-teens, I thought 1910 was a good official date.
Well, that's interesting because you do start, and we should say that there is your work here looks at American history in that time, particularly in the pre-Civil War era, in a very different way, I think, than most people have, both from an academic standpoint, but also sort of generally just a perceive. Tell us about that insofar as you see the Mississippi Valley and yes, sort of a coalition there more dominant than what I think we perceive is the reality of the pre-Civil War, like North-South.
Right. As you suggest, I mean, the book starts in Mexican Texas in the 1830s, around the time of what we call the Texas Revolution. And in part, it's a reflection of my interest and making one of the main arguments, which has to do with the relationship between empire and nationhood. And one of the things I argue is that, in fact, with the birth of the Republic in the late 18th century, the United States begins not as a nation, but actually as a union with very large imperial ambitions over the continent. And so much of the 19th century can be seen as a massive struggle for control, not only of the North American continent, but by extension, much of the Western Hemisphere. And to suggest that the world of the United States is a very large one already in the 19th century. And Mexico not only figures very importantly, because by this point, the British and the French have been defeated on the North American continent, and the Mexicans are the main rivals for continental control, and that the Mexican state that was newly independent in the early 19th century faces many of the same challenges that the new American state faces, which is that it's a very, very large territory, that it's a weaker center, and that there are broad peripheries over which the state is interested in extending its authority, and that's not very easy to do. So one of the arguments I make in the book is that there are a whole series of rebellions that take place in the United States in the first decades of the 19th century, not only, obviously, the largest being that we call the Civil War, but that it's in the process of contending with these rebellions that an American nation state will come into being. I also, as you suggest, make an argument that the axis of American politics that we usually look at in the first half of the 19th century, which is sort of North-South, is more of a political construct for developing movements both in support and against slavery than a reality. And that in terms of the political struggle I see unfolding, it's one that actually sets the Northeast against the Mississippi Valley. And the Mississippi Valley Coalition has a very different view, a vision of the American future. It connects slaveholding and non-slaving holding interests largely within the Democratic Party. And its vision is of constructing an agro-commercial empire that is not only continental, but potentially hemispheric as well. And I argue that when this coalition falls apart, as it does, over how to deal with the question of slavery, the slaveholders' rebellion follows soon after that.
There's a lot of things I want to ask you from that, but I guess working backwards from where you just finished, like what mm-hmm. was the different vision? What was the competing visions between? I mean, you say a like an industrial agro. The phrasing escapes me at the moment, but what? How did that different in terms of? Both economic in economic terms and in sort of cultural terms from the East or any of its rivals it perceived, that coalition?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a very good question. I think what you're looking at is a developing struggle between forces in American society who see a certain kind of developmental vision built around the expansion of market relationships, the development of infrastructure networks that are not only domestic but global as well, a more active role for the central government in promoting economic development. One also built around a certain idea of evangelical Protestantism, which is extremely important in the first decades of the 19th century, and one that is increasingly critical of slave labor and will become a sort of a central force in trying to build an anti-slavery movement, the exact goal of which is not going to be entirely clear. Whereas the Mississippi Valley Coalition, I would argue, is not interested in a powerful central government, is much more interested in ideas about state rights, and is much more suspicious about the kind of manufacturing and urban society that seems much more associated with the Northeast. And their vision is much more agriculturally based. Their idea, you know, articulated very powerfully, not only by slaveholders, but by people like Stephen Douglas, is that, look, you know, empires don't have clear rules about social and political organization. They're mostly interested in just drawing, you know, constructing relations of power. And Douglas felt that, you know, if people wanted slavery, that was fine. If people didn't want slavery, that was fine. But his vision, I think, was an alternative to the kind of manufacturing urban sense that was becoming more dominant in the northeastern part of the country, and that this is something that was going to be fought out over the 19th, in fact, would continue to be fought out over the 19th century, but certainly the Civil War ends up being a very, very decisive battle.
So the argument is that if you want to be in the empire business, you can't really be too ideological, I guess, or have too many strong convictions, because, look, you know, the bottom line has to be you want to expand, and so it's got to be.
Well, I do. Yeah, that's a good point. But what I would say is that probably the dominant element in the Mississippi Valley Coalition were slaveholders. And they had a view of empire that was actually of a slaveholding empire, one that might include, certainly would include the Caribbean, because the annexation of Cuba was sort of a central idea. It might include Mexico, and it might also include other parts of Latin America, especially Brazil, which was a place where slavery was still legal. So I think they were certainly driven by a vision of what this empire, at least social basis, would be like. I would add that an imperial vision was really, really widespread among political leaders in the 19th century. And a lot of it, as I try to suggest in the book, really focuses on the Pacific, because from early on, even when the Pacific coast of North America was nowhere nearly within American hands, there was clearly a sense that this was the future and that American policy should be organized around gaining access to the Pacific coast, if not bringing the Trans-Mississippi West under American control. But those in the Northeast, those in the Whig, and that would become the Republican Party, had a more incremental vision of the expansion of American empire. The idea was that you developed a much more denser process of economic and population growth as you expanded westward, whereas the Democratic Party, I think, was very, very interested in ideas about settler colonialism and encouraging the expansion of agriculturally based societies.
What happened to that coalition? In other words, if the Civil War reimposed sort of a north-south divide, mm-hmm. which, you know, right. in many respects you can almost still see in the voting patterns today.
Yes, right. Well, there's no question that the election of 1860 kind of flags some of the directions we've moved in.
Well,
yes.
So what happened to that coalition? What happened to that? Was it just wiped out?
Right. Well, I think basically what happens is that, you know, Northern and Southern Democrats kind of maintain an alliance based on an idea of what they call popular sovereignty, which is that people who lived in terror, first of all, that the federal government would have no control over the issue of slavery in the states where it was legal, a position that was also accepted by the Republican Party until the midst of the Civil War. And secondly, that the issue of territorial expansion would be decided by people who lived in those territories. And so the possibility, whereas the Missouri, remember the Missouri Compromise of 1820 drew a line, right? Remember, north of that line, slavery was excluded. South of that line, slavery was possible. Southern slaveholders were very, very critical of that, and they saw popular sovereignty as a way of potentially opening the Trans-Mississippi West to slavery, slaveholders, and the expanding power of a slave regime. The problem came when, you know, Northern and Southern Democrats had different views of how this would work, and more to the point, when the Supreme Court ruled in the Dred Scott decision of 1857 that the federal government actually could not prevent slaveholders from going into the Trans-Mississippi West, it raised real questions about how popular sovereignty would work. And Stephen Douglas, who was the front runner for the Democratic nomination in 1860, alienated these Mississippi Valley and other slaveholding Democrats when he kind of suggested there was a way around this. And the way around this was that if people who lived in a territory didn't want slavery, all they had to do was not enact a slave code, because then slaveholders wouldn't have their property protected. And so by 1860, how things fall apart is radical Democrats, especially in the Deep South, demand a federal slave code, which is not something that Douglas was willing to accept. And it's this process that divides the Democratic Party. And given the rise of the Republicans, who are the first mass political party in the United States that is organized around anti-slavery principles, that radical Democrats and increasingly secessionists in the Deep South begin arguing that not only is secession constitutionally viable, but that if the Republican Party gets into federal power. So the election of 1860 is really interesting because, in a sense, it's not a contest between people who want a strong state and people who believe in state rights or state sovereignty. In a sense, in 1860, you have one side saying the federal government has the power to move against slavery in areas under its jurisdiction. And on the other side, you have these slaveholders who say, if we win, we want the federal government to impose a slave code. So it's the rebellion of these slaveholders take place after they lose.
So there's a conflict there, and that conflict hasn't gone away. I mean, certainly you see the Republicans today will talk about states' rights when it comes to, say, abortion rights. But when it comes to, say, legalization or decriminalization of marijuana, it's a different ballgame.
Well, that's true. You know, there's no question about that. And state rights sentiment in the 19th century as well. First of all, it was most strongly based among slaveholders who did not want any outside authority intervening in their relationship with their slaves. But on the other hand, it was a concern that federal power might not be sympathetic to their interests. At certain points, they clearly were interested in using the power of the federal government to help them. When they saw the potential of federal power in hostile hands, they had a different view.
Can you outline, just jumping around a little bit here, you refer mm-hmm. to the Civil War as a rebellion, and you refer to this entire period as a series of different types of rebellions that mm-hmm. Put down in the name of essentially of becoming an empire on some level.
Yes.
What are some of the more prominent ones? Obviously, the Civil War is a pretty prominent one.
That's the largest, right?
But what are some of the others?
What I try to remind readers is that, you know, it's very easy for us to look back, and so much of the official history of the United States was written in the post-Civil War period. I mean, that's when academic history writing really took off. And as you know, the winners end up writing the history. And so we kind of look back and we have this idea that the United States emerged as kind of a solid nation very early. And one of the things I try to remind readers is that the power that the central government had over a vast territory was kind of loosed, and that it was not easy, especially once the Pacific coast became part of the United States. There were a lot of really centripetal forces at work. And so what I try to suggest is that if you look in the first half of the 19th century, you have separatist rebellions in the lower Mississippi Valley. I mean, think of where Aaron Burr ends up getting involved. You have Native American rebellions of several forms, but the most formidable being the Second Seminole War in the 1830s, which is actually the longest war in American history until Vietnam, that the federal government is involved. You have the nullification crisis in South Carolina, which pits the South Carolina slaveholders against the Jackson administration in the 1830s. Way out in the Great Basin, you have the Mormons who are trying to organize their own state. They want to call it Deseret, and actually end up running federal officials out in the 1850s and force the Buchanan administration to organize federal troops. It's called the Mormon War. There are all of these battles that are taking place. And one of my arguments is that the American state and American nation that we come to know develops in relationship to these rebellions and to the process of establishing central authority. And it's not entirely clear how this is going to go, certainly until the Civil War is concluded in the way in which it is, which establishes, at least legally and politically, the sovereignty of the federal government. Now, as you suggested, too, this is something that will continue to be contested and remains contested to the present day. But it's a tremendous tipping point. And what it will mean is that though both the Union side during the war, what I call the War of the Rebellion, the largest of these, and then the social and economic forces that are organized chiefly in the Northeast end up putting their imprimatur on the course of development. And in the second half of the 19th century, one of their large battlegrounds is in the Trans-Mississippi West.
I wonder if this question may be outside your portfolio, but I wonder if that dynamic where there are these rebellions, and because you do talk about capitalism in its growing, and I wonder if these rebellions. And this dynamic of putting down these rebellions to maintain some type of power, if it's not necessarily just about federal authority, but if we don't still see those today, or we didn't still see those through the 20th century, and I'm talking about where you see like the emancipation of black people, of women, on some level, I guess, for the Great Compression of labor in some way.
You absolutely. Know,
like, I mean, just talk about that. Is that built in? I mean, are we still feeling that dynamic?
These are fantastic questions, and they probably deserve much longer answers than we have time for, but let me do the best I can. First, one of the points I try to make is that American capitalism that really gains traction in the post-Civil War period, and in that way I'm intervening in a debate among historians and other academics, but one of the points I try to make is that you can't really understand the development of American capitalism without all sorts of complicated relations that involve the state, and that in the second half of the 19th century, in good part, this involves the police powers, both of the federal state and of state and municipal governments working on the side of employers to tame and in some cases repress rebellions. I call them in one chapter insurrections on the part of a developing class of industrial workers who are pushing back against the forms of capitalist industrialization that are taking place. The other thing that's really important in this is that, sometimes we have played, of course, the idea of maybe a deal could have been cut to prevent the Civil War. But, one of the things that the Civil War produces is three powerful amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, that in many ways reconfigure the entire Constitution. And the 14th Amendment in particular, is not only establishes birthright citizenship, but establishes rights claims that not only African Americans, but all sorts of groups who were outside the official arenas of American politics, you know, women, I mean, later on, obviously, issues about sexuality, LGBT rights, Chicano, Latino rights, are all grabbed onto and used very, very importantly, so that on the one hand, the Civil War, the Rebellion, creates a nation state and empowers the federal government in new ways, and yet on the other hand, establishes ideas about citizenship and belonging that have long-term resonance, not only through the 19th, but through the 20th century and to the present day.
And so, I'm curious too, because I know, you know, you write about the Trans-Mississippi West. There was a little bit later, you know, towards the end of your your book, I guess. This is where also you get sort of the anti-monopolist. Fervor and more populism and if we didn't, you know,
yes,
we're just watching sort of like a battle that goes back and forth with an ebb and flow. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, you know, there were all sorts of things that I must confess that for, you know, I've mostly been a historian of the American South, and when I started this book, I was really interested in much more fully integrating the Trans-Mississippi West into this story. And, you know, one of the great things about doing this work is you're constantly learning new stuff. And I began learning all sorts of things. I mean, I knew about it, but I didn't really know about some of these things in the depth. I mean, one of the things that's very clear is that, you know, the Trans-Mississippi West, as well as the post-emancipation South, become important proving grounds for American imperial activities overseas later on, partly because the federal government territorializes the Trans-Mississippi West, partly because the federal government looks at the Trans-Mississippi West as effective colonies of the East and the area of the country east of the Mississippi River, the Northeast and the Midwest. And because the post-Civil War period sees a very, very rapid process of economic development, some of which is enabled by the federal government. Think of the transcontinental railroads, the use of the federal military. The United States Army is a force for capitalist development in the Trans-Mississippi West. And therefore, not only does this happen very quickly, and a lot of the main players were empowered during the Civil War, but the backlash is also very, very formidable. And the alternative ideas about you know, what the country could be like, and how this development of capitalism could be at least limited or reformed or undermined or rechanneled, is very, very strong. And so movements like the Greenbackers and the populists and eventually socialists, I mean, one of the things we don't know, you know, don't recognize very well, is that the strongest socialist states in the first two decades of the 20th century, where were they? Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Louisiana. You know, these are areas that had seen an enormous amount of political unrest, social democratic impulses, populist, big P populist impulses. And these come in response to the rapid industrialization of these areas, and they leave important legacies to the progressive period and to the, you know, period of the 1930s and the New Deal. I mean, think about the connections between Henry George and Edward Bellamy and some of the radicals of the you know, 1930s out in California, and in other parts, Huey Long in Louisiana, and, you know, social democratic radicalism in East Texas. So, you know, it's an important aspect of the American story, the 19th century turning into the 20th century, that we can very easily forget.
Do you have a sense that that there is that this tension between the rebellions and the sort of the resolving of them, if this is still going on some fashion, do you have a sense, is it possible to sort of say what era we're in now? I mean, or is it,
yeah,
is there,
believe me, I think about this every day.
Well, where are you today
on this? I'm
sure
you do.
Yeah. I mean,
well, I mean, I think, you know, I do believe that that we were moving into a new era of, you know, a new kind of global political economy that was coming into shape as early as the 1970s. But certainly, I think, you know, the end of the Cold War is a very important marker in trying to come to terms with the complicated both national and global politics. You know, by the 1970s, the American industrial economy that was built in the 19th century and came dominant in around the globe as a result of the Second World War and into the post-war period is being challenged on many fronts. A shift from an industrial to more informational and service-based economies, certainly in those areas that had been industrialized, and really a backlash on the part of finance and industrial capital against the gains that working people had made between the 1930s and the 1960s. But I think the end of the Cold War really reconfigured the landscape of politics around the globe, but also in the United States. And I don't think we've really quite understood what that's going to mean. And I do think in important ways, you know, like you, I'm sure, we're all trying to figure out what to liken the recent election cycle or the recent, you know, politics of this country. And I can't think of it. I mean, I think we are in some new, I mean, people said, well, it's kind of like the 1850s and the Whigs and things like that, or the Know-Nothing Party and nativism, but it's not actually. And I think it really has a lot of very distinctive features that is frightening. You know, you could say, well, is it like the 1920s when, let's recall, the Ku Klux Klan was the largest popular political movement in the United States? You know, certainly something that traded on not only vigilantism, but anti-Catholicism, anti-Semitism, as well as racism, which is, it was kind of a proto-fascist movement. It raised a lot of questions about what didn't happen in the 1930s. I do think that what's happening now seems the most like, you know, what was happening in the 20s and into the 30s, but I think it also has a lot of very, very distinctive features because the global economy has, you know, change so much too. So I don't, you know, I have to say, I mean, my new project is on what I call the illiberal tradition in the United States, which I might add, I think it's much more deeply rooted than we often own up to. Mm. And I don't really think that this moment has easy historical analogies. I mean, I think it's really distinctive in all sorts of ways, which mean that it could move in any one of a number of directions, some more encouraging, others, you know, frightening.
Do you think, I mean, if... I mean, my grandchild is interviewing, let's say, your grandchild on whatever medium.
What will they be saying?
Well, not what just that, but will there be, has the pace of history sped up because of the nature of technology now?
Well, it has. But, you know, one of the things I think we need to recognize is that, you know, we use this idea of globalization as something that's only now happened. And in fact, any kind of historical perspective demonstrates that, you know, there are all sorts of stages of globalization that go back way, you know, back centuries, certainly to the 14th and 15th centuries, when new ideas about global interconnections are really important. They were central in mounting, you know, slave regimes. They were central in creating all sorts of commercial ties across continents. The forms of communication began to develop very, very rapidly. Yes, I mean, there is a sense of things. On the one hand, there's a sense of things moving very quickly, and then there's also a sense that things really never change. It's the right. same old stuff. I mean, that's part of the critique, you know, the sort of quote-unquote populist critique, is that, you know, here we are again, you know, being exploited by a small elite. I mean, there's certainly resonances with what we call the Gilded Age, where, you know, the enormous inequalities of wealth and power were the stuff of popular rebellions on all sorts of fronts. You know, we're facing challenges that, you know, I don't know what our grandkids are going to talk to each other about, but one of the things they're going to talk to each other about are the consequences of climate change.
Right.
And whether as national states, and as global communities, we're going to be able to do anything about them, because at least it seems that the crisis is coming nearer and nearer to us. So I do think that this is an issue that is kind of hovering over everything. And as you know, the kind of migrations that have been taking place that seem directly related mostly to political unrest and conflict is going to be accelerated by environmental changes, and it's going to be displacing people all over the place and complicating the kind of political struggles that are taking place today that seem to be based mostly in what's, you know, warfare that's taking place, or regime struggles that are taking place in a lot of other places. I mean, the one, you know, encouraging thing to me is that, you know, the Trump does not really have a youth movement. I mean, this is something different. If you look at the, you know, the bases of, say, German and Italian fascism, the 1920s and 1930s. And secondly, I think a lot of young people are actually interested in getting involved in politics, people who had been, you know, not directly involved. I know my son is one of them. And, you know, I do think that just as there's a kind of a global politics of anger, we call populism, which I don't think is a particularly good label for it, there is also, you know, global possibilities of alternatives to that. And, you know, like many historical moments, you never really know. You know, one of the things about studying history that's so interesting, and you try to remind yourself of and encourage your students to realize, is that, you know, there are benefits and perils of hindsight, because you forget that people who were living at the time didn't know what was going to happen. And they acted in ways that might seem odd to us, as people who do know what's going to happen. And I must say that as a historian, I feel somewhat at a loss for understanding either what's going to happen in the next 6 months or what's going to happen, you know, in the next decade or two. And I think there are many, many different paths that could be followed.
Well, I have to say that regardless of one's status as a historian, I get the feeling that a lot of people feel that way. So,
yes, I do. Absolutely.
Stephen Hahn, the book is Nation Without Borders, The United States and Its World in an Age of Civil Wars, 1830 to 1910. We will put a link to that book at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. There you have it.
I'm a big fan of that book.
Matt is a big... That was a Matt pick, I think, too, even. I mean, that guy... as soon as Matt says he's a big fan of the book, you have to immediately imagine, what does that guy sound like at two-thirds, quarter, you know, two-and-a-half times speed.
Well, they don't usually do their own, do they?
Sometimes they do, but I don't think Stephen Hahn does his own. It's a long book. I think it's like 30 hours or something like that.
All right. Folks, we're going to take a break. We're going to head into the fun half of the show, but let me just give you a little bit of taste of what you can expect. We're going to be providing 100% less Michael Brooks today than normal. He's not here. Michael is he's got some big shindig in Detroit.
He's at the Sustainable Brands Conference in Detroit.
That's part of his brand core brand proposition to talk at Sustainable Brands conferences. Folks, we have audio. I mean, everybody, I imagine now, seeing the picture of Donald Trump surrounded by Saudi royalty, putting their hands on an orb, which apparently, you know what they say, when you're famous, when you're powerful, you're a leader of a country, the orbs will let you just put your hands all over them, and there's nothing they can say about it. But with that said, there was some very strange takeaways from some administration officials about this Saudi Arabian trip, and we will cover that in the fun half. Also, you remember National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster. Just there is value in watching these guys destroy their reputations, because it's these reputations that people, I mean, this to me goes back to when we bombed Syria. Every single person was talking about, I trust Mattis, McMaster. Yeah, Trump's ridiculous, but we can definitely engage in this next war because of McMaster and Mattis. And so every time one of these guys, and I'll reiterate this, but every time one of these guys hurts their reputations by shilling for this administration in an embarrassing way, an angel who is allowed to get booked on cable television to argue against going to war gets its wings. And we will talk about that as well. And then, you know, there was a moment between Anderson Cooper and Jeffrey Lord, which was funny, but also was sort of indicative of a problem with our media, broadly speaking. So all that and more in the fun half. Of course, we will take your phone calls. Ladies and gentlemen, this program. Now, I'm sure there's tons of programs out there where you get to hear a Pulitzer Prize winning author of history books talk about the 1830s to 1910. I'm sure that happens all the time. No, probably not. The point is, if you like that, if you feel like, wow, I learned something interesting today, and it's applicable to my life or our experience, and I appreciate that. Also, things have been going good for me at work, and I really need that to have two Carmel Frappuccino chai teas every day? Well, if all those things are bouncing around your head, I've got the solution for you. Become a member of the Majority Report. It is your support that keeps the show alive. You can go to jointhemajorityreport.com. And to say thank you, you don't even have to have it if you don't want it. But, you know, it'll be there. We give you an extra hour of material, more than an hour. But I like to manage expectations of content a day. And if you're one of those people who you don't have the financial means and you have irritable bowel syndrome, you would never get that chai thing anyways. Well, you don't want to get the coffee with the milk. And you would like the fun half, please send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We'll take care of you. Don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And if you buy your crap from Amazon or from jet.com, head over to majorityreportkickback.com. Click on the link. Use some methodology to always find that link in an easy way. And you purchase your stuff through that link. We get a kickback. You will notice no difference. All right, folks, tomorrow I think we're going to see Trump's budget. We're also going to find out whether or not the administration is going to continue to make payments for Obamacare in terms of subsidies. And if they don't, man, it's going to be a huge mess, a huge mess. We will find out more about that tomorrow. And then, of course, you know, who knows? We could also find out that Jared left the airplane or got pushed out of the airplane flying somewhere. Who knows? All that. But we're going to take a quick break. Head into the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number. See you there.
Say yes.